Welcome to season 4 of the Coffee and Geography podcast. The aim of the show is to get to know, explore, and celebrate the diverse and intersectional range of people and their love for the world. Join your host, Kit Marie Rackley, and have fun exploring all the myriad of ways guests can connect their lives to geography. Today, let's listen to Anti-Racism Work, Diversity, and Inclusion in Rural Areas, The Dilemma of Tattoos, Lived Experiences and Identities Between Rural and Urban Areas, amongst other things. Got your brew ready? Great! Enjoy the listen.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Coffee and Geography. I really hope that if you're listening to all of these in chronological order and you listen to last week's, you're not shivering in pain in sympathy for me after last week, having done during electrolysis. I've told my current guest here that that's exactly what happened. Now, in terms of recording, that was only yesterday, even though these episodes are coming out week by week. But moving on from that, because my face is still a little bit puffy, a bit stinky, I am here with Shabnam. And how are you, Shabnam? Good morning. Is it good morning?
Good morning.
Just about?
Yeah, it is. It's just about. Exactly. No, I'm good. I am good. I've not come from the electrolysis.
I know.
As somebody with ADHD, I quite often stay up quite really late when I'm not supposed to, and I can't help it. And so I was this morning thinking, my God, are my eyes going to be puffy this morning?
Well, you kindly said that you don't think my face looks too puffy. I mean, you know.
No, it doesn't.
It's been 24 hours-ish since the first zap, so, you know, of yesterday. So, yeah, it's probably come down a bit. And I do slather my face with aloe and as much as I can and take ibuprofen and sort of. But anyway, enough about that nonsense. Every three seconds, they heard this beeping noise last week, right, on the podcast.
Oh,
and that's every time I was being shocked. So I'll leave that for them. We'll move on. So to introduce Shabnam, everybody, she is an anti-racist educator, passionate about authenticity, equality, and empowerment. She has been in primary education for over 20 years, in education in general for 30 years, serving diverse communities such as a class teacher, SENCO, head teacher, and trustee. She describes herself as a neurodistinct Northeasterner. Now, I'm going to ask you what you mean by that, because that's the first time I can't even say it. That's why it's so new. Neurodistinct Northeasterner who's been subverting from within for way too long. Here for decolonial japes, and it's probably too much for most, but I love it. That's exactly why you're on the podcast. So a neurodistinct, I mean, obviously, if I can put those two words together and guess what you mean by that. But for you as an identifier of yourself, what do you mean by neurodistinct?
So I'm like really passionate about how society kind of others, anybody, any group, you know, marginalized or just that's different. So like when people say, oh, I'm neurodivergent, it's sort of, I keep thinking, yeah, I know, but just think about that word, right? Okay, neurodiversity. When we say biodiversity, we understand that that is just the norm. Biodiversity just means all the different types of creatures, etc. But then when we say neurodiversity, it's like, oh, well, hang on, but, you know, you're neurodiverse because you're a bit weird and you have something. It's not me. And it's like, no, hang on. Neurodiversity is everybody. You know, there are neurotypes include the so-called neurotypical. So I like to kind of just use distinct as a, I can't remember where I heard it. I haven't coined it. Mm. And I just thought, yeah, I like that. I like that I am distinct rather than different, you know, it kind of gives me a bit of agency and a bit of, to kind of shout from the rooftops about what it's like to be autistic and have ADHD. You know, I mean, there are kind of so many different ways of being neurodistinct as well. So, yeah, that's why I use that. And Northeasterner, because I am, you know, I was brought up in the Northeast, all over the Northeast.
Yeah, we'll certainly get that. Don't you worry. But I'm going to have to practice saying neurodistinct now. Ooh, I got it. got it first time there.
There you go.
I've a few conversations both in and out of this podcast, actually. I've been on a similar journey with that term actually as well myself, because I was like, because I am certainly in that category myself. I haven't been diagnosed with anything official like ADHD or anything like that, but I have every single trait in the checkbox for that. And yeah, I've gone through this journey about thinking, well, neurodivergent. I was like, okay. And then slowly over time, I was like, that's sending shiver down my spines. And then you got neurodiverse, which was a little bit nice because it sounds a bit like biodiverse. But then again, you're right. It's like, well, you just, you know, you're calling a spade, really, aren't you? Because we're all neurodiverse.
Yeah, yeah.
And so neurodistinct. Yeah, I love this kind of morphing of this term, which is to make it more appropriate. And yeah, so I'm gonna have to practice that one.
Try and practice that. I mean, all of these words are really hard to say. And I quite often I'm in seminars with my students, and I'm like, repeating the word 3 or 4 times before I get it right. It's like just that they're all so long and complicated. But I think, yeah, I mean, it's sort of one of those, because I haven't been formally diagnosed, which is another kind of, you know, bugbear of mine in terms of this diagnosis and kind of the sort of pathologizing of something that is normal and natural, and making it seem like it's a problem or some sort of disease or something I carry around with me. It's like, you know, I don't carry it around with me. It is me.
Yes.
And if I know I am, I know I am. I don't need somebody to tell me that I am, you know? I mean, it's actually the same with illness, isn't it? If you're ill, you're ill. You feel it. You know it. You might want some help from somebody, but I could get on my soapbox about diagnosis.
It shows how powerful language is, though, isn't it? Because if you break down words like illness, you know, it's describing the fact that you don't feel like yourself. Yeah. So there's something wrong with your body. Whereas wellness is obviously the opposite of that. So you're feeling well. So yeah, things like what you're saying, ADHD, autism, they are not illnesses if you feel they're part of your core. And I was thinking exactly, I was doing that whole, you know, when people go, yes, and they click like that. When you're like thinking with my identity as well, it's like, yeah, there's nothing wrong with me. So why is it treated as such as it's a contagion that needs to be? But anyway, we'll go, you know, I've done that soapbox. I'm not here to talk about myself. Before we get cracking with some really cool stuff we're going to talk about, do you have a particular brew with you at all today? Or do you have a tipple that you usually go for?
I do. I have a cup of tea. I like a cup of tea in the morning at any point, actually, also before I go to bed. So I have got a cup of tea. I know some, you know, your guests are talking about what it's in. Mine's just in a cup with lots of cats.
I like it.
I'm not sort of, I wouldn't call myself a cat lady. I do like cats, and I have a dog as well. But I live together, in my apartment with, 3 of my kids. My eldest son is one of them, and his, partner. And these are their mugs, actually. They've got all the cats and all the dogs, but I like it. And this is a weird thing. So, if my tea is in a in the wrong kind of mug, it looks like dishwater and I can't drink it. If I poured this tea into another mug and it looked weird, I couldn't possibly drink it. So I think it's something to do with mugs that have got like white inside them, they're okay. But if they're dark mugs, and I like dark mugs, so I've got this thing about pottery. I'm a bit of a pottery nerd and a glazing nerd. So all the mugs that I like the look of, tea doesn't look great in them.
I get that.
I don't, there's probably something, you know, something scientific, something to do with color spectrums and all of that. Don't know what it is, but it, yeah, has to be in the right mug.
So people listening, why do you have a favorite mug, right? Could it be what Shapnam's just said, folks? Could that be part of the reason why you have a certain favorite mug? Of course, we can have favorite mugs because they were a certain gift from someone special, or, you know, I don't know how many mugs you got from being a teacher. I got quite a few myself. but one of my favorite mugs is the world's okayest geography teacher mug, given to me by an ex-student called Elise, who was a very funny young lady. She was absolutely lovely. So I treasure that mug. But if I have a certain drink, I have to feel like it's got to be in, it can only be like in a certain few mugs. Like, and there are tons of mugs in the cupboard in the back, picking up dust, up not touch. They're perfectly serviceable as mugs. They're probably nice. They're quite pretty, but I always go for the same mugs time after time. She says, drinking out of a flask, and there is a reason why I'm doing that.
I noticed that.
So I'm drinking out of a flask mug because when I went for lunch with colleagues the other day at the university, they had this really lovely winter tea brew, which I love the sound of. It was like cinnamon, orange, and some other fruits in there. Just an infusion of stuff. And they put all that stuff in the mug, and then they just gave you hot water, and it was gorgeous. And I loved it. So as soon as I finished it, I just stuck all that stuff in my flask, took it with me, and I've just been refilling this flask with hot water ever since, until I know the taste is gone. So that's why it's – and I'm putting it in this small one rather than just tipping it into a big mug, because otherwise I'm just going to down it all, you know. It's almost like
– Sounds delicious.
Yeah. So, but that's – yeah. Yeah. I'll have to look that up a little bit more about
I need to find I think it is fascinating. A lot of people do, don't they have a favorite mug, and like, why is that? I like the look of things, I really do. I'm kind of a bit of an aesthete, but it does seem weird. And I can put that same mug of tea into another one and it will look really watery. I don't know why.
We're onto something here. And folks, if there isn't a stream of research on this right now, get on with it. Get on with it. Come on. I want to see the research papers. So you've said also that you're a northeasterner and you're located currently in Sunderland. So is that your stomping grounds then? Has it always been your stomping grounds up there in Sunderland?
It's a strange one, Sunderland. So I mean, I grew up. My parents were doctors, and we invariably, when I was, you know, very young, we kind of lived in hospital flats and that kind of thing, you know, went around. So all over the northeast while my parents were working in hospitals. And then my mum sort of took she became a GP, we settled in East Durham, in a new town called Peterlee. And at first of all, we were actually in one of the pit villages called Horden, and we lived above the surgery. And so I lived sort of there. Then when I left home and I started work, I ended up working in Sunderland, and I worked for NatWest of all places. Okay. worked there. So I kind of worked there and lived in Peterlee. And then I left and I went to university in Sunderland as well. And that's where I trained as a teacher, still living in Peterlee. And then when my middle son, just before my middle son was born, we bought a house in Sunderland. And I've kind of just been back and forth from here since then. So since my late 20s. It's kind of always featured. I moved away for about 15 years, you know, went to the northwest, and kept my place here, and we've returned. So it's to the same apartment as well. So it's a really strange kind of journey coming back and actually seeing the city change over that time. My youngest and I, we went for a walk in one of the parks, the main park in the city, and I was kind of just talking to him about sort of, you know, history, geography, and about the fact that, you know, where we live, we're really lucky. We've got three big parks, but they're all very different. So we've got one which is a very natural kind of park. You know, it's sort of lots of overgrown bits and sort of pathways through woodland areas and sort of wild grass and all of that. And then we've got a park that's sort of been landscaped slightly, but it's been renovated. I think it was renovated in 2009, so just as I left Sunderland. And that's got sort of structured natural areas as well as, you know, sort of a play area, etc. But it's kind of been made to look natural. And then we've got the main park in the city, which I was telling him is like a Victorian landscape park, and how they're all very different, and he was kind of like spotting the, you know, how they, you know, what makes them different. So to see, you know, it's things like I said, you know, how the city has changed and over the sort of past, oh gosh, well, like I say, 20 years. My middle son was born here, he's 24, so, you know, we've seen a lot of changes.
Yeah. And a lot of people listening who are geography teachers, Sunderland is like a big place for a case study, a lot of different case studies, usually surrounding like the old industry and like,
yeah,
on like the Nissan car plant or something like that.
So I did 2 weeks placement at Nissan when I did my degree. And I was actually on the factory floor. I had to, I was working with a guy who put in the back, like the back windows of the cars. They were doing, it was the Micra at the time. And, you know, you had to kind of, that was his job, placing the back window in there. And I was there because I was doing my dissertation. And my dissertation was around maths in the workplace. So I kind of like conducted some, you know, interviews with all the guys on the shop floor about whether they thought they were good mathematicians or not. And, you know, did they like maths at school? Because they used a lot of mental math. So this was around about the time of the numeracy strategy coming in, you know, and so that development of mental math strategies, and that there wasn't just one way of doing it, you know. And these guys were amazing. They were so quick. And yet the majority of them thought that they were terrible at maths. Right. You know, they were like, oh, yeah, didn't do maths, didn't do well at school with maths. But, and they had to do like on the spot because they, so the, you know, they had sort of like this competitive element that, you know, you've got to get as many done as you can in the time. And so, yeah, they were great at calculating how many bits of glass or whatever, or, you know, that they were doing. So that was my my little foray into Nissan for 2 weeks.
Amazing. Yeah, well,
this little 5'2" South Asian, you know, girl in amongst all these big guys.
That's really interesting. That story is just perfectly illustrates, doesn't it, how in some ways our education, I mean, I know I'm talking preach to convert, how our education system is severely flawed. You know, how can someone who, where maths is so integrated into their job, and from what I've heard from, I mean, I've never worked in a factory, but my grandparents' generation in particular, and to an extent before my dad joined the police force and my mum became a VD operator, you know, the generation where they were starting to put paper-based stuff on a computer-based stuff. You know, they worked in an old factory, and there were a lot of identity is embedded in being those kind of workers and those kind of secondary industry workers. And so for them to, you know, for them to not be able to appreciate those inherent talents and skills that they have, that they must have to succeed at their job that they're so passionate and proud about, and you say, well, and so to say, well, what you're doing actually is there's such a disconnect, isn't there, between, well, school has been trying to teach you that these maths are important in life, but they're not seeing that. And yet me, as a geographer, certainly, and, you know, my friend, best friend, Clive, who used to be a maths teacher, we used to go around saying, well, you know, you will be using this in real life. And then all the kids are saying, nah, I'm never going to use this in real life. These folks still think they're not using it, but are actually doing a better job with it because of the applied nature of it.
Because exactly, and yeah. I think that's it, isn't it? It's about applying it and seeing it in context, you know, that kind of made a difference. Plus, they were all of a generation, you know, I'm talking about, I was at university in the mid-90s, so these guys will have been at school, you know, sort of a good 15 years before that as well. And the idea that it was all about sort of, you know, the mental calculations, you couldn't kind of, go away from the strategy that you were taught. You know, it's this is how you do it, and that's that. So if you couldn't do it like that, you thought you were rubbish at math. And, you know, whereas they developed mental strategies to work out calculations that were much faster. You know, so yeah, it was fascinating, really fascinating.
It's just, I mean, I like the darts sometimes when they come on once a year, the professional darts come. And there's so many interviews with darts players, and they turn around and say, oh, you must have been brilliant at maths at school. And they're like, no, I was rubbish. And yet they can calculate exactly. They're in the middle of throwing a dart, and they can calculate exactly what they need to throw. It's like, I'm like, come on. It's like, we're teaching math all wrong, really. And we should be like doing these kind of dartboard in the classroom, for heaven's sake.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It might be slightly problematic, I'm sure, for some people. But
The climate, energy, and cost of living crises has us all thinking about how we power our homes. If you're looking to switch for any of these reasons, see if one of Octopus Energy's tariffs is right for you. Octopus Energy are not sponsors of this podcast, but they do supply the energy to the house where it is made. If you make an informed choice to join Octopus Energy, use the referral code READFOL15. That's READ, as in the plant, foal as in a young horse, and the number 15 to split 100 pounds. The split received by us will go directly towards continuing Gia Grambling's education efforts, like paying the subscription to maintain this podcast. If you missed that referral code, check the show notes for a link.
Yes, so going back to your identity again. So you said that you had quite a substantial time in the Northwest. So I guess was it the Cumbria area, I believe?
So just below, yeah, Lancaster.
Lancaster.
That's where I was based, yeah.
So 15 years is quite a substantial amount of time. And so what would you say then in terms of, first of all, these geographically they're the either side of the country, you know, you're the northeast, the northwest, you know, for us down here in the south it's just the north, right? So but you know, you just get on the motorways and it just says in great big, you know, on the blue signs, the north this way, and everything's north. So but did you notice then a very distinct kind of characteristics culture between the northeast and northwest, and has you today, you know, merge some of those identities into yourself? Is there a bit of Northwest in you as with your living with your Northeastness?
That's really interesting. I hadn't kind of thought about that, but definitely I think we've kind of brought, you know, some of the Northwest sort of back with us. And having grown up, like I said, in the Northeast, in cities and towns, and having to kind of go out to countryside, but the coast was really important when I was in the Northeast. You know, the coast was always there, but when I went across to the Northwest, that went missing. Even though, you know, you had like Morecambe Bay and you could have gone kind of further down to like Blackpool, but where I lived in Lancaster, you were removed from that. And it was also on the wrong side, if that makes sense. So, you know, you kind of traveling down the M6 and you're thinking, wait a minute, but the water is on the wrong side. So going north and south, it was really quite, you know, it kind of, your spatial awareness was affected, because for so many years, you know, traveling north, the sea was on, you know, on my right hand side, it was there. And then if you travel north across the other side, it was on the wrong side. But the landscape was very different, and it was, you know, the sort of the trees are different over there, and I noticed that a lot, you know, that the kind of there was a lot more sort of it was more deciduous, it seemed, over that side than it is over here. But again, because probably to go to, you know, kind of woodlands and forests, you're going sort of north again from the cities to get out and get into Northumberland, you know, or you're travelling west into Durham and sort of towards the Pennines to sort of get that countryside. So I think we became more involved in nature as a family, I think, being over there. It was a lot less urban. I remember saying when I moved over there that I did not own a pair of wellies or a waterproof coat.
That's sacrilege from my point of view.
just didn't
understandable.
And now I've kind of come back over here, you know, and I've got walking boots, I've got wellies, I've got like full waterproof, so the whole lot. So it was a culture shift, I think, in that way. And like I said, so my youngest was born over there, and he now coming here, he notices the difference. It's much more urban. His lifestyle is much more urban. To the extent that, you know, the reason I'm able to do it without any interruptions today is because he's out at a group doing an outdoor ed day. So I home educate, and a Thursday is his outdoor ed day, and they go off to sort of a little bit further west towards Chesley Street, Lumley Castle. And there's a lot of kind of woodland there, and they've got a brilliant camp, and, you know, do all of the good stuff that he was used to doing when he was over in the Northwest.
You do get the sense of, you know, the rural urban split when you think of the Northeast and the Northwest, but I'm just thinking, without that, If you had ever always stayed in Sunderland, you know, what that kind of experience for you and your kids would have been, how it would have been different, you know, whether you would even have a pair of wellies nowadays That's just such a simple observation that you've made that I think has got a lot of people thinking about, well, actually, because of course we talk a lot about the differences in lived experiences between, you know, and of course we hate lumping people into categories, and we'll come to that shortly, but you know, the difference, there is a stark difference between folks who only have had an urban upbringing or have only had an urban rural, you know, there are such distinct differences, and there's differences in demographics, there's differences economics, in income, in social stuff, you know, lots of kind of stuff is so much separated by rural urban and even when it comes to like the suburban areas as well.
Well, you've just kind of hit on it, you know, that actually a lot of it is to do with our identities. And so, you know, yes, I grew up in kind of urban areas, and we always went out to do the nature, you know. It was like we would actually, as when I was a child, you know, we would go to the Lake District. We'd go to the Lake District. We'd go up to Northumberland. We'd go on days where we would experience, we'd go up to Scotland to experience nature and the countryside and all of that. And interestingly, going over and living in the Northwest and having the Lake District like half an hour away, you know, I started to see that as a brown person, as a brown woman, you know, that these spaces are so white.
Yes.
And not actually welcoming, you know, you were, and I kind of, you know, I don't think I saw it so obviously, but it's like, you know, well, you're not from here, you're a tourist, you know, and actually thinking, well, no, this country is mine. You know, I was born here, I've lived here. It's sort of, so to feel that some of those spaces were not welcoming was quite a shock, you know, and sort of because, as I say, previously we would have visited them as tourists, but not in the same, you know, no, I didn't realize that that's how people were looking at us, that that's how people saw us, that we did not belong. Right. I mean, didn't belong full stop, you know. So, I mean, that was a bit, I think people didn't see that either. They didn't, you know, people who know me would be like, yeah, but you surely didn't feel like that, you know, in those spaces. And I was like, yeah, no, there are lots of spaces where I could feel people looking all the time, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
And that comes with that territory of having, you know, when your skin is a different colour, that it's, well, what are you doing here? What are you doing in this space? This is not a space where you belong. And sort of Cumbria is very much like that. You know, it's a very white sort of space. Which sort of led me onto the work that I do, you know, in Cumbria with Anti-Racist Cumbria.
Which is actually what I was wanting to move on to now, because it's a really, really good segue, actually. So on your Twitter profile, because I'm saying Twitter, you've got listed that you're the educational lead, I believe, for Anti-Racist Cumbria. So yeah, I think this is a perfect time for you to kind of like segue onto that, because I think this is really fascinating, interesting work. And it says, Anti-Racist Cumbria is a registered charity creating response to the Black Lives Matter movement with the ambition of being the first county which is actively fully anti-racist. So this is really fascinating.
It's always been there. It's always been something as a, you know, a woman of colour. But I think... not really coming to terms with that myself either, and the impact of racism, not just outward, right, you know, sort of the obvious racism that people experience and still do experience, but those, you know, that institutional, systemic kind of racism that exists, and the subtle ways in which it divides and it marginalizes. So I kind of followed them through the pandemic, and sort of thought, this is a great organization that started up. I really need to get, you know, go and meet these people. And I would post and sort of comment on their posts, and I left headship sort of just before the pandemic, and then decided to do an MA. So I'm sort of still doing my MA just because I kind of have a lot on. But my MA was in race and decoloniality. So I thought I need to know more, and I need to educate myself, and I want to actually do something explicitly rather than it being just a thread going through. And it was through that I started work as a lecturer. And then those, you know, started those connections with ARC, with Anti-Racist Cumbria, and a job came up. You know, they were looking for somebody to support schools and organisations. So I kind of thought, well, I've never done this kind of thing before. You know, I've not worked for a charitable organisation. You know, nothing to do with the sector. Went for it. You know, the job at the time that was going was for sort of like a grassroots community worker. And I kind of went for it, did it, and they loved my presentation. But rightly, somebody else got it who had done work in that field.
Right, yeah.
But they got in touch and just said, look, we absolutely love what you had to offer, but really we think this isn't the job for you. We want to make, we want to create something where you can support. And so they got some funding, and this role was, you know, came out of that. And so I worked with schools across the county, working with sort of teachers, not directly with children, but with teachers and head teachers on their kind of anti-racist journey. And some of the difficulties that they face are to do with this this idea that, you know, there are people don't understand lived experience, and they don't you know, they don't know what it's like to be the only black person in the village, you know, that resonated, because where I lived in Lancashire, you know, we were the only family, and it was very visible. You know, you go to the pub and people would look, you know, walk down the street to the village post office, people would look. The work that they're doing is tremendous. I mean, it's just grown and grown and grown. We do a summit every year. This year, the summit we had, David Olusoga was our keynote speaker. So, you know, to get somebody like that to come along to an event was phenomenal. You know, but the audiences for those conferences just continue to double all the time. And it was fascinating. It was a great day seeing so many people come to educate themselves as well, you know, and to find out and to show solidarity, I think is amazing. So they're, you know, I absolutely can see the organization go from strength to strength. It's run by, you know, three incredibly amazing women that are just inspirational. You know, they are phenomenal people. So much energy and just honesty, you know. And I think that's what's important. They are honest about what is going on and what needs to happen, and they don't pull any punches with anybody, you know. It's like it's been a really real privilege to work alongside people like that, and the sense of community is something else, you know. When people hear about and are kind of signposted to injustice, I think people start to come out and show solidarity and kind of go, yeah, look, I need to do something about this, and that is very visible there, very very very.
That sounds absolutely amazing. Yeah, it's and for those, and I'll shout out to these people as well, because for where I can relate with my own lived experiences to kind of really be confident in your identity and do that work of trying to help people understand it and to educate people, it is so exhausting. It can be frustrating, it can be upsetting, and you can you know, I coined a term based on something else called the visibility paradox, where you want to be visible, you want to show that, you know, we are out there in the community, we are parts, all this kind of stuff, and yet it always seems to fall on us to do these kind of things. But so hats off to folks like those three people, and of course demographically, I mean, when I looked at the census information, the last census in 2021, because I was really interested in the new data about gender identity and sexual orientation. But then when you look at other demographic information, then that part of the UK is not very diverse in terms of those different characteristics. It's one of the least diverse parts of the country. Now, here down in Norfolk, we're better is not the right word to say, but we're slightly more diverse, but we're still in the high 90s of being quite homogenous. And so there's parallels between Cumbria and Norfolk in that respect, very rural county, all that kind of stuff. And here we've, you know, some growth is going up with the Norfolk DEI group, stuff like that, who are teachers in the area in a Suffolk DEI group, and that kind of stuff. And then you've got these folks in Anti-Racist Cumbria, and then we've got nationwide, we've got the Decolonizing Geography group, which I'm a part of as well, to give a shout out to them. But it is tiring work, especially when if you're from Cumbria and almost everyone around you is like you, and the only news you hear of other people is what comes from, you know, usually it's the bad news. Usually it's there's riots because of Black Lives Matter, or there's protests because of Gaza, you know, and all these kind of things. And so when you see a diverse range of people of all creeds and colours doing their marchings down in London, but up in Cumbria, that you look around you, well, I can't see anyone like me who's marching on that kind of thing. Then it's them who's doing that kind of stuff. That makes it even harder.
Yeah.
So
What a place to do this work, Cumbria. It's probably the hardest, one of the hardest places in the UK this must be done. Not because the people are probably are angrier or they're more racist or anything like that, but just because their lived experiences and their exposure to the wonderful diversity of this country and this planet, it's just not as much as everyone else.
No, exactly. And in terms of educators, you know, as a teacher, that has to come back to us. We've got to do that, you know, and it's yes. important. It's more important in areas where there is a lack of diversity to actually teach about, you know, what it's all about, you know, that our society is still racist. It's still racist. It's still homophobic. It's still transphobic. It's still all of these things. We're not in some, you know, utopia, or we haven't actually, we think, people keep saying, oh, but we've come so far. And it's like, yeah, but have we? Have we really come that far? No, we haven't. We've only come a tiny, tiny bit.
Yeah.
And then every time we take steps back,
but
surely.
From whose lens have we come far?
Exactly. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's people wearing those rose tinted glasses who have not. Has had the intersectional experiences or lived experiences.
Yeah.
They're the ones who tend to say we've come far. And I used to say that. I used to say that as a white person.
Yeah, but this is it. Yeah, I mean, I said to my students only the other day, you know, I said, look, when we talk about things like white privilege, we're not just talking about skin colour. You know, we all have our proximity to white. Not we all, but, you know, I can speak myself and say, I have proximity to whiteness. Yep. You know, I'm middle class. I have all of these things that offer me privilege. But you have to then, like, you have to be able to acknowledge that. And like you say, look through different lenses, because it's not just people who look like you, but it's people who are exactly. positioned like you as well. And I have to acknowledge that there may be people who look like me, but actually, my position is different to theirs because I am afforded certain privileges. So I have to check those privileges, you know, I have to check those and kind of go, hang on a minute. Yeah, I might be okay in this particular context, but that's because I have that privilege, you know. So let me put myself, let's think about the lived experience of the other person and like how do they see it? You know, what is it like for them? And that's, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, so as I say, brown woman, cisgendered, but, you know, I'm autistic, I have ADHD. And I think a lot of those, you kind of look at the kind of, if you look at like a wheel of power and how much of that do you have.
I've seen visualizations like that.
Yeah, and I think that's, we all need to just sort of take a look at ourselves and see that, we might think things have moved on, but exactly what you were saying, because of our privileges, and we need to kind of put them aside in order to have some impact.
Painful is not really the right word, but it was awkward for me to admit it because you know, it's not part of my identity, but I've now come to realize and be comfortable in saying that I benefit from the residue of male privilege. So, for example, because, you know, even though I'm not male, because I was presenting as such and being treated as such for most of my life, I have benefited from that male privilege. So, but now that I'm, you know, you do have to go, so people listening, you do have to go through that discomfort. Mm. It's necessary. But when you come out the other side of that, you feel so refreshed and you feel a bit liberated, to be honest.
Yeah,
you know, every time I have a chat with someone like you or someone listening to this podcast, or I get called out on something, I have that initial, you know, especially when I get called out on something, I get that initial shudder, discomfort, but then I realize why I'm having that discomfort, and it actually is, it's like you know, the spoonful of sugar with the medicine kind of thing, you know.
Definitely.
So I love it. I've got addicted, as I said to you before we start recording, I've got addicted to it actually. That feeling of being made uncomfortable for the right reasons, and then going, wow, I never looked at it that way. That's actually opened my eyes. And then all of a sudden another color gets added to your palette when you're looking at the world.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
It is beautiful. You're right. And I think, you know, as an educator, but also as a parent, I'm kind of trying to be as open as possible to that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like I said to you before we started recording, you know, that you have to say, right, this stops with me. now.
Yes.
This is the time to stop it. We've got to do something about it.
Hey, educators. If you teach any geography, environmental or human or physical science-based topics, then check out Kit Marie Rackley's website at geogramblings.com. There you will find musings, blogs, resources, analyses, and more. Perhaps you want to brush up, learn, or dig deeper into a geographical issue? Or you're looking for a resource you can use in the classroom? Or maybe looking for someone with an award-winning, diverse expertise and skill set to collaborate with you on a project? Kit Marie offers free 30-minute friendly consultations if you're looking to brainstorm ideas. Jog on to geogramblings.com to explore and find out more.
Well, so we're a little bit over time, but I want to get 10 more minutes in here. I'm putting that aside. I still want 10 more minutes with you, right? Because I'm loving this chat. There's a few things that you've mentioned that you've got a love of rocks and pottery and stuff like that. I'm going to see if I can combine two things for Spill the Beans, really, because see if I can twist this a little bit, but you can take it how you like. Now, you say that you would absolutely love the idea of getting a tattoo, but you can't stand the thought of getting one. So I'm just thinking, is there any way... Can we combine rocks, pottery, and tattoos somehow? I'm clutching at straws here, to be honest. But, okay, all right. If there was a design that you would see, I've got it. Mm. You may have thought about this. You may not. This may be a new thing for you. I might be giving you an idea for a tattoo. I don't know. So you can get some really intricate designs which only seem to go well on pottery or rock art or something like that. So okay. Is there anything you've got? Or you've seen in terms of the pottery world, you're thinking, you know what, that design, that would look pretty cool as a tattoo. See what I did there?
Oh my God. Is there something that I've seen in the rock world or, oh, crikey.
I'm putting you on the spot here.
You are. I have no idea because I don't really know what the, I mean, so with pottery, I love it. Like I said, it was more the glazing and I love, the way that you can get that sort of raku glazing where it's sort of and just the idea of the way that you don't know what's going to come out of the kiln, you know, you put all the stuff on and then it comes out and it's all, so I don't know if that could be done as a tattoo, like, you know,
and my wife did something like that. Yeah, you get some really lovely lines and stuff like that. I don't know that kind
exactly.
Of
exactly. I mean, what would you do? Yeah. And your dad would probably have to do it all the way around my arm, yeah, exactly, or something. Like,
well, people do have bracelet tattoos and stuff like that, but then that's really in the nervy part, and that would be really squeamish.
The whole point of me like avoiding tattoos is like because I'm absolutely scared of needles. I don't like needles, and everybody kind of goes, "Oh, it doesn't hurt very much. It's fine. It's all right." And I just kind of, I mean, you with your electrolysis. I mean, as a cis woman, I have a lot of, well, pretty kind of menopause. I had a lot of testosterone, you know, and I was a very hirsute, like a young woman. And so like upper lip hair, I would have thought about, you know, keep thinking about electrolysis and it was like, oh my God, no, but it's like invasive, anything invasive. And it just, like having my eyebrows done, I still haven't even ventured there, so you know. But I am desperate for a tattoo, but I don't know whether it would sort of be rock, and I like rock formations, you know. I kind of love crags and screes, you know, the really pointy sort of glacial stuff. Yeah. That's what I really love. I mean, I guess what I could do, I mean, I don't think I would. I'm not saying I'm going to do this.
But, I promise I won't hold you to
this. Having spent most of my life in Sunderland, obviously we have Marsden Rock on the coast, sort of not far up from us. And I mean, you know, as people do. People have things to do with their heritage or whatever, don't they? So I could maybe have a tattoo of Marsden Rock.
That was just a little fun little thought experiment for you. But things that if you feel like you want to go for it, I'm sure you can find plenty of tattoo artists who have sympathized with you. Numbing cream is it's a godsend, right?
I've got to do it, haven't I?
So I use this numbing cream. You get it from the farm. It's not cheap, but if you just want a little tiny tattoo, start off with a little tiny tattoo, then the numbing cream. And the thing is, I don't know if anyone realizes this, folks, but if you've used numbing creams because maybe you've had a mole removed or something, I don't know, or something like that, under local anesthetic or whatever. But because I got this whole area that needs to be done, I have to like lather it on, you know, like in the movies when they put on the old shaving cream. And then I have to, I look ridiculous, but it has to be done because it has to go on an hour before or an hour and a half before. So I have to cover that with cling film. I use this eco-friendly for cling film. So I look like, I don't know how what I look like, you know, when I'm driving and people are looking to the appointment. But you don't have to do that for if you're only getting a little tiny tattoo, then just a little bit of numbing cream. And it does say on the instructions to wrap it in cling film, which is not bad if it's going to go around your arm or something like that. But it works wonders because I had a few hairs and my upper lip pulled out without numbing, or where the bits where I didn't quite get the numbing cream, and that was painful. But yesterday, folks would have heard on the podcast, I didn't say out or ouch or anything or any time. In fact, it was Abby turning around saying to me, can you just shift this way? You're pulling your head away a little bit, you know. But that was it. So the numbing cream, it works wonders. So
I feel like I do. I need to get one. It is one of those things that I'm absolutely, you know, I desperately want to get one. I mean, they're also very expensive, so it's you know.
you do pay what they're worth with the talent.
I'll have to start up a savings pot and then, you know, and then go,
folks,
go and get one.
Come on, yeah. Coffee and geography. So, you know, if you want to contribute towards.
Yeah. Getting shrapnel under the needle.
Oh, well, we'd have to bring this wonderful chat to a close now. So the last bit then, we are all geographers. So are you ready to this then? Well, we're going to link you back to you to my sadist.
Electrolysis.
And she, so she did a great job talking about rictus, which is the grimacy smile. I didn't even know that was a thing. So when someone smiles like that, you know, grimace smile, or you know when you say smile for the camera, I am smiling. No, you're not smiling, smile for the camera. That's a rictus smile, right?
A rictus smile.
So that's what she had to do. But she said, I'm going to think of something job related. And I don't even know if you know what this were, but she's gone through electrocautery for you.
Electrocautery.
Do you know what I had to look it up. Do you know what it is?
Is that like where they like cauterize your... It sounds like, is it to do with that, cauterizing
hair?
This
is great for someone who hates needles.
Like they stick, like, because it goes into the follicle and they have to like...
Yeah, so it's often used during, it's used during surgery to remove unwanted or harmful tissue and seals the blood vessels. It helps to stop bleeding during surgery or after an injury, and it is it's a completely safe procedure. But I just realized now that it probably should have come with a content warning if you don't like needles. but anyway, you can take that however you like. So it could be part of the definition. It could be that in itself. You could just talk about how much you hate needles for 30 seconds.
I could. Oh my God. Right. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it on documentaries where they do it. I'm not squeamish and I'm not.
Okay.
But,
right. I'll give you 30 seconds to just whatever you want about it. For 30 seconds. There we go.
Okay, I don't know. This is really, she's totally thrown me. I hate needles, but I get that you would have to use that sort of process. I don't know. No, you've stumped me.
The first time I've had it flummoxed.
You flummoxed me.
Abby, you flummoxed my guest. What are you doing?
Really,
you stabbed me with needles. You caused all me all this pain.
And then you flummoxed me.
You're causing my guests pain as well. Oh, never mind. No, it was a treat. I, in all fairness, I would have struggled. So I'm trying to think.
The only thing I would have said, but this is, I'm now pulling on my geographical knowledge now. I'm thinking like maybe there might be portable electrocautery kits for responders to places where there's been a major disaster, like an earthquake or something like that, and them having to do on-field surgery. That's the only thing I could really think of.
Yeah, a bit of social geography. I was still stuck on rocks.
That's my fault. Look, whenever these things kind of happen, folks, don't blame the guest, you blame the host. You always blame the host. The guest is always wonderful. But you do get to have your own back in a way. You get to pay it forward to a next guest. So any word you like, as long as it's not related to needles.
Okay, so I'm kind of gonna throw a HDMI.
That's cool. Not had anything like that before. I'm trying to find something to write it down when I have a computer in front of me to type it down. That's our ADHD going now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. This is it.
That's right. So HDMI, we'll have that then. So for the next guest, folks, they are going to have to link HDMI. Well, if they can link HDMI to geography, that's fine, but just HDMI in general. I know it's high definition. Is it high definition media interface? I think that's what it stands for. I'm guessing. I haven't actually looked it up. But anyway, okay.
They tend to be the bane of people's lives, don't they?
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah, especially, let's see, how many ways is it a bane? You walk into a place where you're given a presentation. Do you have a HDMI cable? No. Oh, I've got a HDMI cable. Oh, sorry, we only have a VGA port. The HDMI cable's not working. It's not,
I have an HDMI. Oh, no, now I need a SCART socket.
A SCART, now that's going back. That's SCART. Oh, folks, okay, so we're going to... We're letting this now. So you've said some hellos and some shout outs to those wonderful people at Anti-Racist Cumber. Is there anyone else you'd like to say hi to?
I think I've just got to say a big shout out to my kids. You know, they are all unique and they absolutely define who I am. So I've got Matt, who's just landed his dream job. He is the marketing manager at Newcastle United Football Club. And I know that's scandalous living in Sunderland.
I was about to say, yeah. Well, congratulations, Matt. You better doff that hat and glasses.
Yeah, I think he's gonna have to go out
collared coat when you're walking around Dublin.
Go out in incognito. So I've got Matt, I've got Shani, who teaches English down in London. She's doing her PhD on trees. So you know, more geography links.
They're on
the
podcast.
Oh God, that'd be fascinating. I've also got a shout out to Charles, who's my middle son. He is a poet and spoken word artist, and is a trans activist. As you know, I am a mum to a trans son. And then my youngest, Milo, who is just he's just amazing. He's absolutely hilarious. Love him to bits, and he's out there climbing trees and doing all sorts today.
I'm getting proud mum vibes off you.
Very much so.
Yes. Oh, that's amazing. That's left me full of, got off my heart. It's
warm vibes. All warm vibes. Yeah.
And I know people can find you on Twitter.
They can find me on there.
Twitter.
I mean, a bit.
Yeah. So you've got your Twitter is Shabs Anam, so it's SHABSANAM.
Yes.
And then your website is dewdropeducation.com, I believe.
It is, and they can find me on there. Like everybody, I think we're trying to limit our social media as much as possible.
Absolutely, yes.
And get outside instead.
What a lovely note to end. Shab, I've really had lots of fun today. Thank you so much for joining me for this time, and I've had everything. You know, we've got on our soapbox, rightly so. We've got passionate, we've gone deep in things, but we've also had a big laugh, and that's exactly
it's perfect. Been a pleasure. It's been wonderful. It has been great. Thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had fun. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the podcast and give us a rave review. Make sure you share and rate each episode, as every time you do this, It helps more people find us and continues the conversation. If you fancy being a guest or have any feedback, follow us on Twitter at @coffeegeogpod and send us a DM. Or you can email us at coffeegeogpod@geogramlings.com. Until next time, keep jogging.